with our first case, Ralston Investment Group versus Blank. Ralston Investment Group versus Blank.
Good afternoon, justices, opposing counsel, may it please the court. My name is William Oliver Jenkins of Broadkey, Cudahy, Peebles, Belmont, and Lyon. I'm appearing here on behalf of the appellants, Ralston Investment Group, Jim Linhart, Alan Bennett, and Kevin Hitzman. The appellants are before the court today seeking a reversal of the trial court's order entered June 27, 2018, and a remand with instructions to find in favor of the appellants on their causes of action. This is a case of four shareholders who agreed amongst themselves, along with Ralston Investment Group, to shoulder outstanding liabilities of a fledgling gas station and convenience store in hopes of turning it around and making it profitable. Jim Linhart and Alan Bennett, at the time of the agreement, each had a 30% interest in Ralston Investment Group. Kevin Hitzman, the other appellant, had a 20% interest in Ralston Investment Group. The appellee had a 20% interest in the Ralston Investment
Group. Counsel, when you referred to an agreement, when did the agreement arise that each of them would contribute on a pro rata share?
We contend that the evidence shows through testimony and in Exhibit 61 that the oral agreement between the shareholders really began in around March of 2006. That is a time when there was a fifth shareholder prior to that time who sold his interest to Kevin Hitzman and the appellee because he wasn't interested in continuing with the fledgling gas station convenience store. There is some dispute on the record as to exactly the date and it happened, but it is undisputed that it did occur sometime in and around March of 2006.
And that's the contract that you claim was breached here, the one from March of 2006.
Yes.
An agreement where all the parties said all future contributions, we're going to agree to pay in our pro rata share when there's a cash call for the business. Is that your theory?
Yes. The agreement had a couple of, and I apologize, I don't know if I can do this now. I forgot to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, if I may. Apologize. Thank you. The agreement entailed the terms that when necessary, they would infuse additional capital into the corporation when needed. The evidence shows that the corporation was unable to pay its promissory note to American National Bank. And that was the primary reason for this agreement, was to make these payments infuse the corporation with these additional capital contributions so that the corporation could pay on the promissory note and not be forced to close down.
So that initial infusion, was that $100,000?
Correct. And okay. That was part of the sale of Mr. Strong, who was the fifth shareholder at the time. That was part of the sale or the transaction of his shares to Kevin Hitzman and the appellee.
Is there evidence that differentiates between an agreement around March of 2006 of the business needs another $100,000, we're all going to contribute on a pro rata share, versus and we're also going to be obligated to contribute any future monies?
Is there any difference in the...
Well, is there any... Because I'm not sure the appellant disagrees on the $100,000 that he agreed to contribute his pro rata share to that one. It's just that he's saying, but I didn't agree to do it for all the future ones.
Sure. I believe that at the time that the transaction occurred, it was discussed and agreed upon that in the future, when needed, that they would infuse the corporation with further capital. I think it was pretty evident at that time that the business was not doing well and needed help, and probably needed help in the near, at least in the near future. And Exhibit 61, I think, clearly shows the conduct of not only just the appellee, but all parties involved, that there was an agreement, because shortly after, and for several years, and every month for those years, especially from 2009 to 2013, they were contributing monthly to the corporation a pro rata share in an amount that was that the corporation needed to pay off the promissory note a month. So I think certainly the conduct of the parties is evidence of an intent to be bound by this oral agreement that was initially agreed to in 2006. Furthermore, the appellee admits under cross-examination that there wasn't an agreement. There wasn't an agreement to put in further funds when necessary. And that can be found on pages 274, lines 10 through 19 of the Bill of Exceptions. And also, again, he alludes to some sort of agreement being reached to on page 296, lines 21 through 25. Under cross-examination, he admits the terms of the oral agreement included providing additional capital contributions to the corporation as was necessary to keep the door open. All these guys wanted to keep the door open. They were heavily invested in it. And especially Appellee makes several claims throughout his testimony that he couldn't afford to have the place close. And unfortunately, he was reaping the benefit of the others contributing for many months and keeping the store open, but wasn't paying his pro rata share as was agreed upon. Furthermore, as I already mentioned before, Exhibit 61 is a clear and strong evidence of the intent of the parties to this oral agreement. Also, Exhibit number 64, particularly pages 4, 9, and 10, L.E. at the very least admits that there's an account stated when he's admits to owing $41,000 in contributions that he hasn't made at that time. Furthermore, Exhibit 65 on page 4, Appellee signs off on a 2014 tax return showing and admitting to the $62,207 loan to the shareholder, which is the amount of the contributions he has failed to pay under the oral agreement.
If there was an agreement to pay, what was the purpose of the promise?
I believe the purpose of the promissory note was to ensure that he was going to timely pay. There were issues with the appellee that the other three shareholders had in him saying, hey, I'm going to make a payment this week and it not showing up. I'm going to make a payment of a certain amount and it not being that certain amount. And I think that the shareholders wanted an assurance from the appellee that he's obligated to pay this. And it was, I think, an attempt to memorialize what the oral agreement had already solidified. And I'm out of time.
May it please the court, Travis Tuttenborn, Klein Williams, Wright, Johnson, and Oldfather, on behalf of the appellee, David Wenk. District Court in this case found that the appellants failed to meet their burden. Both claims asserted against Mr. Wenk. That decision should be affirmed because it is supported by sufficient evidence in the record at trial. Evidence shows that this is a case in which no individual paid more than they were personally responsible for. That statement is true with respect to the breach of contract claim because Mr. Wenk made capital contributions to this corporation throughout approximate 9 years. Corporation then operated gas station and convenience store. The evidence is that he understood at all times that he was under no legal obligation to make a capital contribution simply because requested of him or simply because the corporation required a contribution to remain in business or keep its doors open. Mr. Wenk funded his initial investment in the corporation by borrowing money from American National Bank. He needed this business venture to be a success, voluntarily made the decision to make capital contributions throughout the 9 years in order to give the business a chance of success. The statement is also true with regard to the claim for contribution, because the corporation took out a $1.4 million loan from American National Bank and also a $50,000 line of credit from American National Bank that were both secured by the personal guarantees of the individual shareholders. Those personal guarantees were for up to a stated amount of the debt for each obligation. No individual paid more than the stated amount on the face of their personal guarantees to resolve their liability to the bank. Turning to the standard of review, the standard of review in this case is the same for both claims, the breach of contract and the contribution. I'd like to clarify a point in our briefing because after Mr. Wenk submitted his brief in January of 2019, this court released an opinion in February of 2019 that provided a discussion that led to some authority that resolves the issue. The unpublished opinion is Yates v. Casto from February of 2019. That opinion cites Collection Bureau of Grand Island, Inc. v. Fry from 2000. And in that case, this court explained where none of the extraordinary powers of a court of equity are required in order to give either party the relief he seeks, and a court of law can afford complete relief, the action is won at law. Where a plaintiff seeks only a judgment for money, the case is clearly won at law. The appellants in this case on both claims sought only judgments for money, therefore both claims are actions at law, subject to the standard of review of a bench trial of an action at law, in which the factual findings have the effect of a jury verdict, will not be disturbed on appeal. An appellate court does not reweigh the evidence, but considers the evidence in the light most favorable to Mr. Wenk, resolves evidentiary conflicts in favor of Mr. Wenk, who is entitled to every reasonable inference deducible from the evidence. And the appellant's burden of showing clear error in the findings of the district court is onerous, and it is not met in this case because sufficient evidence was introduced at trial to support the district court's findings. On the breach of contract claim, that evidence comes directly from Mr. Wenk. The testimony from the individual appellants at trial, offered for the first time at trial, was that this March 2006 meeting was where an agreement was entered into to make contributions as needed into the future to keep the doors open. And those were the precise terms offered by each individual appellant. They were the only terms. Mr. Wenk testified that he did not enter into such an agreement in 2006. Mr. Wenk testified that he never agreed to make a capital contribution every time one was requested or every time one was needed to keep the doors open. Mr. Wenk testified that the purpose of the March 2006 meeting was that another shareholder had requested an infusion of capital of $100,000 total in addition to the initial investment. Mr. Wenk agreed to contribute his $10,000, but he did so only after doing something that no other individual in this case did. He sought his own investment. And when he did so, he did not have any bylaws, any shareholder agreements, any documentation at all that governed how the corporation was to make decisions or what the rights and obligations of the shareholders were, because none were ever created.
Didn't he testify that he and his other shareholders were going to make those contributions? Just looking at the citation that was provided during argument by the appellant of a question of your client, wasn't it true that you and your fellow owners entered into an agreement with the corporation that you were going to continue to make those contributions to keep open, objection overruled, yes, when it needed money?
I would say that needs to be considered with the totality of his testimony. That isolated question is not dispositive. If we view his entire both direct and cross-examination, he is clear at various points that he never agreed to make mandatory capital contributions simply because they were requested or simply because they needed money.
So did he agree to make a contribution, a pro rata contribution?
Correct. And his pro rata contribution at that point was 10%. It wasn't until Mr. Strong decided that he did not want to make his contribution towards the $1,000 that Mr. Hitzeman and Mr. Wank purchased his shares. And when they did so, it was the only time throughout the 9-year history of this business venture that the parties reduced the rights or obligations of the shareholders to writing. The attorney for the corporation drafted a stock purchase agreement for the sale of Mr. Strong's shares September of 2006, so 3 months after the alleged oral agreement. The stock purchase agreement is Exhibit 55 in the record. It includes an integration clause. It does not include any mention of an agreement for shareholders to make capital contributions each time one is requested or needed. Doors to the business open.
Question about the contribution claim. Is there any testimony in this record with regard to Mr. Strong, who exits in 2006? What happened to his personal guarantee?
There's not. And there is no documentation from the bank or from the parties. That is unresolved.
The parties appear to brief this as if he disappears and now the allocable shares should be prorated among those that are remaining without any indication as to what happened to Mr. Strong and his guarantee to the bank. Is that right?
That's correct. And the piece of evidence that we have to determine that is the first letter from the bank in which it sets forth the amounts of for shareholders' personal guarantees. The record is silent as to why Mr. Strong's is not included, certainly not contemplated in the stock purchase agreement that any other shareholder assumed his obligation to the bank. There's simply no evidence.
Is there anything in the record that tells the corporate records or anything that tells how a decision is to be made by the board?
There is the testimony of the shareholder. There is no documentation. And the testimony each of the shareholders was that every shareholder needed to agree in order for a decision to be a decision. Mr. Wink obviously did not agree to make capital contributions each time once requested. Mr. Wink also did not agree to initiate a lawsuit against himself, and so the record is confusing as to how decisions were made for this corporation, but the testimony of the shareholders was. And that's also relevant to the contribution payments that were requested throughout the 9 years, because some of the testimony was that, well, our agreement was really that we needed to get together and agree on making a contribution. So we agreed to agree when expenses would come up that we would all agree to make a contribution payment, and that, of course, is not enforceable. So because the evidence in this case is that no individual paid more than they personally agreed to pay, no clear error to be found in the record, we ask that we confirm the decision of the district.
Okay. Any other
time does Mr. Jenkins have?
Justices, appellee misstates that there was an agreement to agree. There was an agreement. As Mr. Wink, the appellee even states. And as far as the appellee's position that it was voluntary, he didn't agree to anything, the evidence is clear that he obviously did. And it was unknown to anybody else, any other shareholder, that he didn't agree to this. His own actions show month-after-month contributions. His own actions and admissions admit to an amount that he owes the corporation. And also, his omissions are very important here, too. He doesn't tell anybody that I don't have to pay this. Rather, he says, I will catch up. He makes additional payments to catch up. He promises to pay. In the emails that are received by the court in Exhibit, I believe, 64. His actions and his conduct are contrary to the testimony he states when now that he's being sued for the money that he didn't pay. And I believe that the evidence is quite clear in this case that there was an oral agreement by the acknowledgement of the appellee, by his omissions, and by the documents received showing the conduct of the parties, not just the appellee, but all parties involved.
How do you respond to the statute of frauds finding by the district court?
Well, the statute of frauds, obviously, and co-counsel brought up the appellant review, and appellant review for law is obviously clearly, if it's clearly wrong, and we believe that the evidence, the trial court got it clearly wrong. As to the statute of frauds, that is one that you must independently reach a conclusion on. It's a question of law. The statute of frauds here is clearly, it's not within the statute of frauds because the performance of the contract could occur within 1 year. They could have sold the business. They could have shut it down within a year after making the oral agreement. Just because it has an indefinite term does not mean it falls within the statute of frauds. It has to be not be able to be performed within 1 year. It's a much different. And as far as the contributions, the whole debt here, the relationship between the guarantees is between the bank and the individuals. They had an oral agreement between each other. The whole debt, the debt that they settled on, 817 that the three shareholders settled on, they were being sued by American National Bank, and the settlement reached by Wink, which is a total of 897. Thank you.
Thank you. Case is submitted. Council is